Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role did Paul Cézanne play in ushering in the era of modern art and forging a path for Picasso, Matisse, and other artists of their generation to explore new ways of seeing and portraying the world? Born in a small town in the south of France in 1839, Cézanne showed early promise both as a painter and as a writer, and befriended the novelist and playwright Émile Zola before he'd reached his teens. But Cézanne saw little critical or commercial success in his early years as an artist and would not mount his first solo show until he was in his mid-50s. He was often plagued by self-doubt, but continued to create stunningly original works until the end of his life. Biographer Alex Danchev is professor of international relations at the University of Nottingham and author of the new book Cézanne, A Life. He's in town to speak about Cézanne this evening at an Arts and Letters live event in the Horchow Auditorium at the Dallas Museum of Art. Alex, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
So the Cézanne you give us in this book is fascinating. He's contrary. He's just interesting in so many ways. Why has he not been more closely examined by more biographers in the past?
He's an interesting example of somebody who was colonized by one particular biographer, a man called John Ruwald, who did a tremendous amount of work on Cézanne and for Cézanne studies. Ruwald wrote a book about him, wrote the catalogue résumé of his paintings, many other things. But he was a very territorial scholar and kept others off the patch. So one explanation is Ruwald, who died in 1994 and made his papers available to other scholars at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. So it became, in some sense, easier to do this after 1994.
So do you start with Ruwald's work and then think, well, what did he leave out and why?
In part, yes. And I think, in general, I've tried to track through the life from the original sources, from Cézanne's letters, from other people's letters, rather than to rely on books that have been published about him. And for one reason or another, that hasn't been done for many decades. Partly, I think, also because there is no consolidated Cézanne archive. It's a matter of detective work, if you like, tracking down sources in all kinds of places.
I wonder, does everyone who is in possession of some of these documents recognize how valuable they are? Or do some people say, well, what I have here doesn't say much. It's just a letter to his mother or to, you know, his neighbor or something.
Yes, I think there's something in that. Many of the letters are now collected in libraries or archives, but there is a tendency for some people to squirrel them away, to keep them close or keep them private. And I think the French, although of course they want to celebrate Cézanne, have not actually done all that much by way of preserving or ensuring his legacy. Curiously, you would have thought that more might have been done.
So let's talk about his boyhood in the south of France. Talk about his education and the ambitions that his parents had for him.
Yes, he was brought up in Aix-en-Provence in the south, and he went to school with Zola. You mentioned their friendship, and the friendship began at school. So this is a very close, very early relationship between two men who became major artists of different kinds. And that relationship is in some ways the axis of Cézanne's emotional life, I think. It was a good school. Cézanne is certainly the most intelligent, probably the most educated major artist of his time. And I think that one of the things that I've tried to do in the book is to demonstrate just how intelligent and well-educated and well-read he was. This is a man who translated Virgil in his spare time, who wrote Latin and Greek, who could talk Provençal, in other words, who could talk to the peasants in the south in their own language, literally in their own language, but who could also talk to the Paris Salon in the language they understood. And one of the interesting things about him, I think, is that it was not easy for people to be sure when Cézanne was being serious and when he was being ironic. And that persists. It's still difficult to know sometimes how to take him. So I could give you an example, if you like. He said of himself that he was a painter by inclination, which could mean simply that he liked painting, he was inclined to paint, but it seems to me is also a rather sophisticated acknowledgement of some of the criticism he received, which is that things in his paintings slanted or were askew, so they were inclined in odd ways. So it's an example, I think, of the way in which he could be very sophisticated in his talk, just as he could in his work.
Did he also cultivate a sort of, did he deliberately cultivate this persona that people had of him, that he was a little off, that he was not all there? And what would be the advantage of allowing people to think you were crazier than you were?
I think he did cultivate such a persona, yes. What was the advantage? Well, I think he liked independence. He sought independence. He didn't want to be tied to a particular group or ism. Mm-hmm. So he was, for a while, an impressionist, a member of the impressionist group, and he was a great friend of Pizarro, who was a leader of it.
Sort of a mentor. Pizarro was sort of a mentor.
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, certainly. But it seems to me that he grew uncomfortable in groups. No group could contain him. There is that. Then I think he always wanted to be free to roam, if you like, literally in the countryside around Aix in the south. He walked tremendously, being outdoors and painting outdoors and feeling a really deep connection with the land was fundamental to him. So it's partly to preserve his independence, I think, and it's also partly to create a kind of persona. Cézanne performs Cézanne, if you like, and part of that performance was a kind of barbarian, a sort of larger-than-life character. So there is a marvellous story of when Cézanne met Manet. Manet, at the time Cézanne was young, was the great example of modern painting and was a very sophisticated person. And in the café that Manet and his merry men frequented, Cézanne went up to him and said, "Hello, Monsieur Manet, I won't shake your hand. I haven't washed for a week."
And what was the response?
Consternation. Which was precisely the response that, in a certain way, he hoped for. Similarly, Cézanne sent in paintings to the official salon in Paris every year for about 40 years and was never once accepted. And often that's portrayed as a kind of deep disappointment to him. And, of course, it's true that he would have liked to be accepted by the salon and recognised and so on. He would only have been human if he didn't. But I think there was another thing. This became part of his strategy, if you like, his plan of campaign. He expected to be rejected. So he was not willing to compromise on the kind of work that he sent in.
So, in other words, he could have fabricated works that looked very much like the ones that were being accepted and guaranteed himself a place.
I believe so. Mm-hmm. But he chose not to.
What do you think? I mean, wanting to be accepted and wanting to be understood makes perfect sense. The sense of independence also makes sense, you know, for someone who sees the world in different ways. It is ironic, though, that this desire for independence sort of flies in the face of his deep financial dependence upon his father.
Yes, that's very true. He did depend on his father, and it was a rather tricky relationship, I think. His father was a self-made man. He began the father in hats, or rather in rabbits. So first you have to catch your rabbit, then you skin it, and the skin makes the hat. Mm-hmm. And he grew so successful at that in Aix in their hometown that he became very wealthy, wealthy enough to buy a bank. So he became a banker by that simple expedient. So he was a very powerful personality, Cézanne's father, rich, independent, and he had certain ideas about what his son should do or be, and being an artist was not one of them. He wanted his son to be a lawyer, and in fact, Cézanne began by reading law at the University of Aix, but left partway through. He referred to himself later in life as a doctor of law. So the father wanted the best for his son. It was just that it was a struggle when Cézanne was so deeply committed to being an artist and so unsuccessful commercially as an artist, which meant that the allowance given him by his father, his annual allowance, was extremely important to Cézanne. It meant that he didn't absolutely need to sell paintings to begin with, which was perhaps just as well, because it's almost literally true that he couldn't give them away for a long period. So he was utterly dependent financially on his allowance from his father.
Was his father's objection, Alex, was it chiefly about the respectability of being a lawyer, the pragmatic value of that, or did his father look at Cézanne's works and think, friend, you're not going to do very well with these?
I think it was the first on the whole. He didn't really examine the art. I don't think he cared about what kind of art it was going to be. He cared about Cézanne becoming a respectable bourgeois, well, lawyer, perhaps banker, so he should be independent financially, and moreover that he should marry well. And Cézanne's relationship with his wife became also an issue with the father.
Yeah, something that Cézanne kept from his father for years.
Yes, for this reason. Cézanne met a woman of humble origins called Hortense Fiquet when he was about 30 and she was about 20. She was perhaps a model. She'd come to Paris to make her way in the world. And they got together and they had a son, also called Paul. And the wife, or rather not the wife, the partner, they were not married, and the son were kept from Cézanne's father for fear of disinheritance. So he's in this rather peculiar and difficult situation of having a sort of secret family for about 20 years.
And at the end of 20 years, when his father found out, things were almost as bad as he might have imagined.
Yes, exactly. And it's no coincidence that Cézanne finally got married, regularizing the situation and legitimizing his son in the same year that his father died.
My guest is Alex Danchev. He is a biographer and professor of international relations at the University of Nottingham. His new book is called Cézanne, A Life. He's speaking this evening to Arts and Letters Live in the Horchow Auditorium of the Dallas Museum of Art. If you'd like to join the conversation or ask a question, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Alex Danchev. He is professor of international relations at the University of Nottingham and author of the new book Cezanne, A Life. He's speaking this evening to Arts and Letters Live in the Horchow Auditorium at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Okay, we've got a bit of biographical information for background. Alex, tell us what made Cezanne's work so revolutionary.
Well, I think the people who saw it first were shocked by it, and in some cases disgusted by it. It provoked a very strong reaction, partly because it looked unfinished. People had got used to paintings where the paint covered all the canvas. Mm-hmm. If it didn't, it wasn't a proper painting. It wasn't finished. Whereas many of Cezanne's works, especially the watercolours, which are in some ways even more revolutionary than the oil paintings, Cezanne would be a truly great painter if he'd only painted watercolours, especially those, but some of the oils too, have a lot of white patches. And in a certain way, Cezanne had the magic of allowing the white paper, the background, to organize the color. So that was one aspect. Mm-hmm. Another is that the colors are mixed up. There are red skies and blue trees, and nothing is as it seems, or at any rate, many things are not as they seem. A third thing, I suppose, is that any given thing in a Cezanne picture could be important. It didn't have to be the human face, or it didn't have to be an important person, or a big thing. There is a marvelous Cezanne painting called Woman with Coffee Pot. And it shows a woman, and it shows a coffee pot, and it also shows a cup and a spoon. And in that picture, for Cezanne, the most important thing was the teaspoon. He says, a spoon can tell us more about our world and ourselves than a woman or a coffee pot. So there is a certain democracy here, a certain upending of expectations. For him, the important issue was not the king or the queen or any of the familiar things in pictures, but perhaps a spoon.
How did he develop his way of thinking about the world in this way? And does that reflect a disconnection from other people in his personal life?
That's a very interesting question. I think his thinking was partly informed by his reading. He was a colossal reader. For a man who's supposed to have painted all the time, he read an awful lot of books. I think that he got up very early, perhaps around 4 o'clock in the morning, and read for a couple of hours before starting painting. And he read contemporary literature, so he was said to know the poems of Baudelaire by heart. He read his friend Zola's works, and through Zola, many of the latest novels and contemporary writing in France, including, by the way, novels or fictions about a painter Cezanne. He was reading about his fictional selves.
Which were not necessarily flattering portraits.
No, indeed. Most of the fictional Cezannes came to a bad end. Several of them committed suicide, for example, a very bad end. Mm-hmm. But he was also reading the classics. And I think it was very important to his imagination, his mental world, his mental furniture, if you like, what he read in the classics, Virgil, Lucretius, above all. And I think that many of the things in his paintings come out of those books.
What sort of writer was he?
Writer?
Yes.
That's a more interesting question than it sounds, because he, at school, he was given prizes for writing, and Zola was given prizes for drawing. And Zola himself says that Cezanne might have made the better writer. In other words, he had real talent as a writer. We know this chiefly now from his letters. And the letters are full of references to books and authors and the figures that peopled his imagination. Towards the end of his life, he tries to convey to younger writers and artists something of his, not philosophy exactly, but certainly his thinking. And some of these letters are extraordinarily interesting.
Why was the friendship with Zola so important? And we can talk about its demise in a few minutes, but talk about what brought them together in the first place. I guess there was a schoolyard incident and that sort of cemented the friendship, but what kept them friends throughout those years?
Well, I think it certainly started at school, possibly with the incident. The incident was briefly that at that time, Cézanne was a big sort of ruffian of a boy who could look after himself, whereas Zola was a little weakling who was picked on by the other boys at school and perhaps quarantined, they wouldn't talk to him and so on. And Cézanne protected him. And one day, Zola brought Cézanne as a present a box of apples. And the older Cézanne, telling this story, says something like, "Cézanne's apples go back a long way." So this is acknowledgement. I think this story is true, not apocryphal, but true. I think this is acknowledgement that the apples that Cézanne painted again and again and again, and he often returned to the same picture, the same subject, to paint it. Apples meant much more to him than merely apples. They meant, in fact, this bond with Zola. And then what kept them together was, I think, their respective searches or quests to succeed as artists. Zola in Paris, Cézanne sometimes in Paris, often in Aix.
He seems to have had sort of a love-hate relationship with Paris. Is that an accurate way to describe it?
Yes, I think it is. He was drawn to Paris for all the obvious reasons. He first of all applied to the École des Beaux-Arts there, in other words, the great art school in France, and was twice rejected. Interesting. The part of his conspicuous lack of success as a painter in his own lifetime in conventional terms.
So in other words, had he been accepted, perhaps the world would have recognized earlier what he was doing and why it was important?
Yes, and perhaps he would have been schooled in certain techniques that would have made his work more acceptable.
Conventional.
Conventional, perhaps, yes. So it may indeed be a good thing that he was rejected by the school. But what it went, I think, was that he never studied with a major painter in a major studio in the way that artists have traditionally done. So we were talking a few minutes ago about Manet, for example. Manet studied with another artist called Couture for some 6 years as a kind of apprentice. Cézanne never had that apprenticeship, and I think he felt the lack of it in some ways.
What does that mean, Alex, to study with another painter? Because I realized I have heard this for years and years and never fully understood how that process would take place. Is it just, does the sort of senior artist give assignments and then critique the work of the younger artist?
Yes, that, and then giving him tasks to do on the senior artist's own pictures, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So you might be given a bit of sky to paint.
You've got the background, right?
Or, yes, exactly, the background, or maybe a part of a tree, or whatever it might be. And so you would learn about composition, about what the master was doing, and you would learn from the beginning the basics of pigments and paint and so on. And Cézanne, I think, had to master that pretty much on his own. And we know now that he did. That an extraordinary moment in the research for this book was talking to conservators at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. And they were working on one of the Cézannes that they own, a still life. meaning that they were X-raying it and studying it in great technical detail. And they focused on an orange, a fruit,
mm-hmm.
and they found that the highlight on the orange had been painted first. In other words, Cézanne had his blank canvas, and on it he painted a few marks that would look like a highlight on top of the fruit, and he then built up the orange through that highlight. He knew his pigments. And this astonished the conservators. They had found nothing like it in the other master paintings they had analysed. In other words, Cézanne continues to amaze in his techniques as well as his compositions.
I wonder if that speaks to the pros and cons of a very rigorous education for a working visual artist. I mean, on the one hand, you can pick up all these things maybe faster than you would on your own, but maybe there is less innovation just in terms of technique. Forget about sort of the overall vision of things.
Yes, I think Cézanne spent a long time copying work he found in museums, in particular the Louvre in Paris, where he would go every week when he was in Paris, sometimes every day, to copy not whole paintings, but little parts of them. So if he was copying a portrait, he might copy the shoulder and an arm. Or if he was copying, there's a famous example when he was copying a Chardin. He liked and admired Chardin a lot. A still life with a fish and a cat trying to get the fish. Cézanne, in copying this, leaves out the fish, the mm-hmm. cat, various other things, and copies a bit of the still life. So it's a very individual, almost idiosyncratic process. He finds his own way by his own devious means.
What do we know about the way he painted, the speed with which a work would come together, how long it would take to finish, where he liked to be?
One of the most astonishing things, most extraordinary things about the legendary Cézanne, and he became a legend in his own lifetime, it's a cliché, but in Cézanne's case it was true, is how slowly he painted. He himself said that a minute in the life of the world is going by, we must paint it as it is. But a minute was not enough. There are stories of anything up to 20 minutes between each brush stroke. So he would make a mark on the canvas, and then he would look again at his subject. He would think, he might walk around, make another mark, and so on.
I can see why he didn't have that many live models.
Live models he found difficult. Mm-hmm. He did sometimes have them. He painted his dealer, for example, Vollard, the great Paris dealer. And Vollard himself claims that it took 115 sittings, a lot of sittings. Some of this may be exaggerated in the telling. And we also know that Cézanne could paint fast if he wanted to. But the hallmark of the reputation, and in some ways I think the hallmark of the work, is long, long looking. And so the painting becomes a painting not only of the subject, of the apples, but of looking at the apples. It's a painting of the passage of time. And that, I think, is one of the most remarkable things about his work.
Among the plates in your book, and I have to say it is just a beautifully produced book in addition to having fantastic content, but you have a number of self-portraits that Cézanne did. What can we learn by comparing and contrasting these about the evolution of his work and of his self-image?
He's a great self-portraitist. Like Rembrandt, he painted himself almost throughout his life. The first one is very young, and the last one, the last of about 26 self-portraits, is towards the end of his life. And they look tremendously various. It is almost as if it's a kind of rogue's gallery of different persons, or at any rate, different personas, perhaps, or aspects of a person. So somehow he sees himself as various, and it's not simply aging, although he treats his own aging unsparingly.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a tremendous variety of, well, outfits, apart from anything else. Whether this has anything to do with his father, the Hatter, he wears a tremendous range of headgear. And the dressing up, if you like, is also a part of the self-portraits. But I think they begin a little showy. It's almost as if he's showing off in the painting. I can do this,
mm-hmm.
or perhaps I can be this.
Oh, that's an interesting turn of phrase, that both of those things may have manifested themselves.
Yes, both, I think. He's not shallow. He's the opposite of shallow. They're already multiple or deep. And then the later portraits do away with that. And somehow we cut closer to whatever is within, I think. And some of the late self-portraits are, I think, very profound studies of a very profound person.
My guest is Alex Danchev. He is a professor of international relations at the University of Nottingham and author of the new book, Cezanne, A Life. He's in town to speak this evening to Arts and Letters Live in the Horchow Auditorium at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you'd like to be part of this conversation or ask a question, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is biographer Alex Danchev. He is professor of international relations at the University of Nottingham and author of the new book, Cezanne, A Life. He's in town to speak this evening at 7:30 to Arts and Letters Live in the Horchow Auditorium at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Alex, how did Cezanne's Catholicism shape his life?
He's always been thought to be rather religious, rather conservative, socially, politically, religiously. I doubt that, frankly, or at any rate, I think it's much more complex than that. His greatest painter friend was Pizarro, who was a mentor to him, as you said. And Pizarro was an anarchist. I mean, a real anarchist. He read all the works, and he was a genuine social revolutionary. And through him, Cezanne read a lot of left-wing work as well, and read throughout his life a tremendous range of periodicals. He went to church, but not always as a strict believer straight down the line, I think. I think I mentioned earlier on that it's sometimes difficult to know how to take him.
Mm-hmm.
And he says of the church that he goes to church because of his wife, who's in the hands of the curate, who is in the hands of the bishop, who is in the hands of the pope, who is in the hands of the Jesuits. Now, that may have been a perfectly serious recap of the sort of religious hierarchy, but somehow I doubt it.
Mm. Well, and it's interesting that he chose, there are reasons for this, but they were unmarried for, you said, 20 years into
yes.
their relationship. She's another one that has been characterized in the past as in a sort of unflattering light, and you have some more empathy for Hortense than other people have.
Yes, I think their relationship meant more to Cézanne than people have supposed. The conventional picture is that they were passionately in love when they got together, when they had a baby, and then they grew apart. She was often in Paris, he was often in Aix, so often they were separate. But it seems to me that, again, that's only a partial story. So Cézanne paints her almost as often as he paints himself, which means that he spent all that time fixing his gaze on her.
Mm-hmm.
And to paint a portrait was for Cézanne to enter into a kind of pact or treaty with the sitter. It was a tremendously important enterprise. And a sort of transaction or negotiation goes on, or a struggle, if you like, for domination. And so I think that these portraits of Hortense, which again span a very long period, are an indication that there was much more between them than we might suppose. And there is another indication. We have only two letters in her own hand, and they're both very interesting. And one of them indicates that she handled business on his behalf, so permissions for illustrations with publishers, that kind of thing. I don't think she would have done that if they had been living just a pro forma life.
Of course, toward the end of their lives, or toward the end of his life, they were not, were they fighting at that point, or were they simply still separated?
They weren't fighting,
mm-hmm.
No.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now to Jack in Denton. Hi, Jack.
Hey, how you doing there? Yeah, I am a sculptor and I teach art appreciation, and I believe Cézanne is the premier artist of the early part of the 20th century, even so adored by Picasso. But my question is, he's a person that was just so rejected as such were the modern artists of the day. Was he picked to, I believe his image is on the French franc as George Washington's is on our dollar bill, and being that rejected and put down in society, to actually have that honor.
I think we've got your point, Jack. Thank you so much for your question. Yeah, how did the transformation happen?
It's very interesting. Your caller puts his finger on a very interesting phenomenon. So Cézanne died in 1906. There have been only about 100 years for him to ascend from being known and valued by his fellow artists to being right up there in the pantheon with Vermeer and Rembrandt and so on. And part of the answer, I think, is the absolute adoration that the successor generation had for him. Picasso, Matisse, Braque, Giacometti, they all revered Cézanne, not only for the work, but also for this extraordinary questing, driving life. And part of the answer is Vollard, the dealer. His dealer bought up 628 Cézannes at his death, two-thirds of his entire lifetime production, and more or less sat on them. So allowing them to appreciate in value and then allowing them to sort of leak out into the public sphere. Cézanne is really the first major artist to be made by a dealer in commercial terms, in public terms, and not by museums.
Why was Cézanne's work such a launching point for Cubism and other modern movements of the 20th century?
Well, I think it is because there is contained in it the the ideas, the seeds of so much that came after. Some of the buildings, the shapes of the buildings in Cézanne already look like Cubist works, and these are the paintings that Braque and Picasso studied. But more than that, I think it's something to do with the life or the legend that these artists appreciated about him. It's a moral question. So Matisse bought his first Cézanne before ever he had much success as an artist. He pawned his wife's wedding ring to buy a Cézanne. And what Matisse always said about his little Cézanne was that it was a moral support for him in his struggle as an artist.
What do you mean by that?
I think he meant that Cézanne never lied, as he said, that Cézanne had an absolute integrity as an artist, that for Cézanne, painting was truth-telling or it was nothing. These were very high stakes, not only in the art in the sense of colours and shapes, but in art as an ethical endeavour, as a moral quest. And it's that that subsequent artists pick up on.
So this idea of truth-telling for Cézanne was about what something meant and not really about how it looked.
Exactly. What he painted was what he felt about it.
I seem to remember reading that he would read works of literature and imagine colors and these sorts of things. Is that correct? Do I have that?
Yes. He says somewhere that when he's reading Flaubert, for example, one of his favorite authors, he gets a sort of purple sensation.
Do you think, are you familiar with synesthesia, the neurological condition? Can you talk about how that might have made him the artist that he was?
I think it's an interesting aspect. I don't know how important it was for him. And I don't know also how serious he was when he was talking about this aspect. Mm-hmm. He seems to have been serious in connection with Flaubert and Purple. But I don't myself think that this was a key to his development.
It has to be maddening at times and exhilarating at others to write a biography of someone who, even when you have his words in hand, you're not quite sure what to do with them and how much to believe and how much to take literally, I should say.
Yes. We're lucky to have about a book's worth of letters. And so I think, as a biographer, as you go along, as the years go by and you immerse yourself in the person, you get to feel, if you're lucky, that you can tell when he's being serious and when he's not, when he really is striving to explain what he so passionately feels, or when he's just kind of fobbing somebody off. So I suppose you get a kind of ear for him, if you like.
Was he as great a misogynist as people have said?
No, I don't believe he was. People have said that he was almost pathologically afraid of women and that he was incapable of really forming ordinary, normal relationships with them. And even more broadly, that he was not only a misogynist, but a misanthrope. In other words, that he was not capable of forming normal relations with practically anyone. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that's true. I think that's part of the persona that he sometimes projected and part of the stories that then were told about him. I think he was perfectly capable of forming normal relations and that he was far less pathological or peculiar in those sort of neuro ways than people have made out. He was much more well adjusted than we have been led to believe.
How did he respond after so many decades of sort of toiling in relative anonymity to this moment when suddenly people did want to buy his works, he was still alive, and he was seeing an acknowledgement of his work over all this time?
I think he realised that that was going on at the exhibition that you mentioned at the beginning. In other words, his first solo show at the age of 56, which turned out to be about 10 years before he died. He knew that this was a breakthrough. But more importantly, I think he began to feel that he was onto something.
Mm-hmm.
He says very movingly in one of his last letters, "Will I glimpse the promised land? Will I be allowed to enter?" And I think he had an inkling that he was the strongest of his generation, of a remarkable generation. I think he thought that he'd become somehow a better painter than Monet or Renoir or Pizarro, all these men who collected him and tried to figure out what it was he was doing. In other words, I think towards the end, he probably felt that he was the greatest painter in Europe. He didn't see the culmination of that, but he had a certain inkling.
At the end of his life, he was quite ill for some time. How did that affect his moods, his ability to work, his drive to work?
He was diagnosed with diabetes in about 1890, that is, for about the last 15 years of his life. What exactly that meant for him is a bit difficult to pin down because we don't have medical records.
Mm-hmm.
He complained of brain trouble, which I think meant that his head hurt, especially in the heat. The heat of the day became very difficult for him. And one of the things that has always intrigued people is whether the diabetes led him to have difficulties with his sight, whether things became a little fuzzy for him, or whether he suffered any partial colour blindness. And of course, this being Cézanne, of all people, any of these effects would be extremely interesting. But I think we really don't know. But as far as we do know, I think we can't explain away the distortions or the bizarrery of the work by his illness. And he kept working to the end. This was an absolute cardinal principle for him. He tells his young visitors, painting to the end. He vowed to die painting, and he did.
Alex Danchev is a biographer and professor of international relations at the University of Nottingham. His new book is called Cézanne, A Life. He'll speak tonight to Arts and Letters Live in the Horchow Auditorium at the Dallas Museum of Art. Alex, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast for free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.